Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started here in just a minute or two. Please stand by. All right, so good morning. This is the media teleconference on the measured size of the Gulf of Mexico dead zone and efforts to predict and mitigate its effects. We're going to go ahead and have an on-time start. And just a reminder that this is an audio press event, and I'm going to go through some of the logistics here and then we'll get started. All right, so good morning. My name is Paul Mickle. I'm the co-director of the Northern Gulf Institute, which is located at Stennis Space Center on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. The Northern Gulf Institute, or NGI, is a cooperative institute with NOAA. And although NGI and NOAA are both hosting this event, I will be your moderator today. Today's teleconference is on the measured size of the Gulf of Mexico dead zone and efforts to predict and mitigate its effects. Just a few logistical details to share with the group, and then we'll get started. After I introduce the panelists, they will each provide statements, and then we'll open the floor up for a Q&A for the press. Everyone will be in listen mode only until the Q&A to mitigate any background noise. During Q&A, please indicate in the Q&A section on the right-hand side of your screen, it's the chat box, that you have a question. We will recognize and unmute you in the order that they are received. If you prefer, you can enter your question in the chat and I'll read it in the order that I receive them. If you are calling in, we will unmute all callers at the end to be recognized and to ask questions. This event is being recorded, and if you have any objections, you should disconnect at this time. If you have any follow-up questions or need additional information or this presentation, please submit a request to pmickle, P-M-I-C-K-L-E, at ngi.msstate.edu. And that's my personal email, my work email, and I'll have, I've put this in the chat in the top. So, and I'll probably put it at the, again, once I get a second here, so that everyone has the email to submit requests. Just a few minutes ago, NOAA posted the news release highlighting this year's cruise results, along with additional information useful for this press group. It can be found at NOAA.gov on the left at the News and Features section under the latest media releases. Let's get started. I'd like to introduce the panelists in order from which they will be speaking. First up is Nancy Rabelais. Dr. Rabelais is a full professor at LSU, distinguished research professor at LUMCON, Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, and the co-principal investigator for the Gulf of Mexico Hypoxia Studies. Sean Corson is with NOAA. He's the director of NCOS, NOAA's National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science. Next up is Lori Sprague. She is the program manager at USGS Integrated Water Availability Assessments, water mission area, and of course at USGS. Next up is Bruno Piggott from EPA. He's the acting assistant administrator at the Office of Water Environmental Protection Agency, acting co-chair for the Hypoxia Task Force. Next is Mike Naig, Secretary of Agriculture for Iowa. Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship for the state of Iowa. He is also the co-chair for the Hypoxia Task Force. All right, so I'm gonna open up for Nancy Rabelais to give her briefing as we're all eager to see how the cruise went and give her information for here at the press conference. Nancy, please unmute yourself if you aren't already, and feel free to start.
Just let me know if you can hear me.
Loud and clear, thank you.
Thank you. Well, the ship, the research vessel Pelican, is either on its way to the dock right now or has already made it there early this morning, where the group mapped the area of bottom water, low oxygen. Sometimes it's called the dead zone. And it's called that because if the oxygen is less than 2 mg/L, fish in anything that can swim usually tries to escape the area. The area this summer was 6,700 square miles, which is about average. Over the 38 years that we've been doing this, it's a little bit larger than average. It's also, its size is 3.5 times higher than the environmental goal of 1,930 square miles set by the Nutrient Task Force, of which there are representatives on this call. It was very close to shore along most of the area, and it extended from the Mississippi River past the Sabine Lake, which is the border of Texas and Louisiana, and almost to Galveston before we had to turn the ship around and had other mapping to do east of the river, which is not available to me at this point. From very close to shore to very far offshore and well up off the bottom, sometimes as much as 5 meters off of the bottom, which means that the volume, not just the area, is large this year. We do not do any trawling or any other kind of work such as that on these cruises. We do collect information on phytoplankton biomass. Those data are yet to be, we have those data. I'll be submitting a press release out with those data with high chlorophyll values near shore, but less than 5 mg/L offshore. So there's not much chlorophyll in the surface waters, but there certainly is a large area of low oxygen in the bottom waters. These cruises take place with funding from NOAA, and they've been going on every year since 1985. We feel very distinguished to be part of this long-term record, and we hope that we are able to keep it going. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Nancy. And just a little background before we move on. So the folks that have joined us a little bit late, we'll have a Q&A at the end after the 5 panelists. And Nancy has just given her summary of the cruise that's currently heading toward completion today. So next up is Sean Corson. Sean, can you go ahead and unmute and provide your briefing? Thank you. Hello, Sean or Clay, can he be unmuted?
I've sent the request for Sean to unmute, but since he's a call-in, he has to do it. There he is. You're on, Sean.
All right. You got me?
Yep, perfect.
Gotcha.
All right. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Paul, and the Northern Gulf Institute, and to the tremendous tech support at the Northern Gulf Institute for getting me on here today and for moderating this media teleconference. I'm going to just touch briefly on NOAA's role on hypoxia nationwide, and then drill in a little bit more specifically to the Gulf of Mexico efforts for this year. NOAA has a congressional mandate to address hypoxia through the Harmful Algal Bloom and Hypoxia Research and Control Act, also known as HABARCA. This guides NOAA's hypoxia research and activities across the United States. The Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Watershed Nutrient Task Force, also known as the Hypoxia Task Force, of which NOAA is a part, is codified in HABARCA, and will also be discussed a little bit more in depth by my colleagues from US EPA and the state of Iowa. Within this task force, NOAA has 3 roles. First, we support research to characterize the magnitude and extent of the hypoxic zone. You just heard a little bit about that from Dr. Avalay. Second, we develop quantitative models to predict the extent of the hypoxic zone. And third, we develop quantitative models to determine the impact of the hypoxic zone on ecologically and economically important living marine resources. These three capabilities combine to enable managers, the Hypoxia Task Force, and other partners to make science-based decisions to mitigate the impacts of hypoxia on the Gulf of Mexico ecosystem. Just a couple words about the monitoring crews and the task force metric. So as Nancy mentioned, NOAA supports the annual hypoxic zone measurement. This is a key metric for monitoring long-term changes in the hypoxic zone and is what's used by the task force to monitor progress toward the long-term goal of reducing the dead zone to 1,900 square miles or less. This dates back to 1985, now contains 38 annual measurements across a wide range of environmental conditions each year. As mentioned by Dr. Rabelais, the measured size this year was 6,705 square miles, which resulted in a new 5-year average of 4,298 square miles. So similar to last year's 5-year average. However, this average is still more than twice the goal set by the task force. So let me just briefly touch on model development efforts, interrelationships with the crew survey and comparison to the measured size. So in June, NOAA provided an ensemble forecast for to estimate the size of the hypoxic zone and predicted an above average zone of approximately 5,827 square miles. This annual forecast is generated from a suite of academically derived NOAA-run models based mainly on nitrogen loading and river discharge data provided by U.S. Geological Survey for the month of May. For this year, NOAA forecasted an above-average dead zone because the Mississippi River discharge and the phosphorus loading in late spring were above the long-term averages during the month of May. The forecast is issued in June, and it assumes typical weather patterns, precipitation, river discharge, between the time of the forecast and the release in June, and the time of the monitoring cruise here in late July, early August. In the fall, NOAA conducts a retrospective analysis of the whole season to better understand the interplay between the chemical, physical, and biological factors on hypoxia formation during the year. As far as living resources, the hypoxic zones lead to habitat loss for several ecologically and economically important species in the Gulf. So we're talking about things like shrimp and menhaden and a variety of other species. Research suggests that there are long-term effects on populations and food webs for mobile species, things that can swim away. These effects result in economic consequences for fisheries they support. So this includes things like non-lethal impacts on reproduction and growth, enhanced predation due to displacement from habitat, and longer transit times for vessels trying to reach these fisheries to harvest them. NOAA has ongoing investments to better understand the long-term ecological and economic impacts of hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico. Major commercial fisheries may also be disrupted because they occur at the same time and in the same places as hypoxia. Scientists from NOAA Fisheries and North Carolina State University are using experimental models to better understand where shrimp can be found relative to the hypoxic zone. Hypoxia often occurs with other stressors affecting ecosystem health and resilience. Understanding the impacts and relationships among these multiple stressors remains elusive and yet are critical to understanding the interactions and predicting future impacts. NOAA is currently supporting several regional projects to characterize the impacts of these layered multiple stressors under present and future climate change scenarios. Finally, I'd like to just point to some advanced technology, some exciting things that we've been exploring recently. NOAA's been investigating new technology to map the dead zone and help augment and complement the annual survey cruises done shipboard. These include autonomous underwater and surface vehicles, and early results suggest that they have been able to effectively map hypoxia near the bottom and in the nearshore environment. This year, several autonomous surface vehicles were deployed in coordination with a measurement survey on the ship to sample the offshore environment and compare them to inshore environment. We're looking forward to analyzing those results and thinking about how we can use these autonomous systems to complement our shipboard surveys into the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean. We appreciate that. Next up is Bruno Piggott from the Environmental Protection Agency. Bruno, can you hear us? And can you go ahead and start?
I can hear you, and I hope you can see me and hear me as well. First of all, I want to say good morning. It's really a pleasure to be here today. Thank you, Nancy, Sean, Lori, and Mike for your work on this important effort to reduce the size of the dead zone in the Gulf. This is such an important effort, and I'm very lucky to work with such a great group of experts in this field. Throughout my career, I've had the pleasure of working with people like you all, water quality experts and resource managers who are dedicated to improving water quality in the Gulf of Mexico and throughout the Mississippi Atchafalaya River Basin. Each year, this basin delivers enormous amounts of water containing nitrogen and phosphorus to the northern Gulf of Mexico, creating the hypoxic conditions we're talking about today, disrupting fisheries, impacting local waters, and the economy of communities around them. Reducing these nutrient loads from this broad geographic landscape where tens of millions of people live and work is no small feat. And this teleconference demonstrates that progress requires collaboration, collaboration among agencies, tribes, and stakeholders. And that's why the Hypoxia Task Force was established. The task force is a strong mechanism for change, consisting of partners with the shared goal of reducing the Gulf of Mexico hypoxic zone. We talked about the goal of reducing the 4,298 square miles over 5-year average down dramatically, and we've got a lot of work to do, and improving water quality across the Mississippi River Basin is part of that effort. We've long supported the Hypoxia Task Force at EPA with general assistance for tribal and state water quality programs and some small targeted grants to states. We know our work is far from done. The Hypoxia Task Force's interim target is to reduce total nitrogen and phosphorus by 20% by 2025, with a long-term goal of reducing the size of the zone to less than 5,000 square kilometers by 2035. Through strong partnerships in the federal family and with states, we are making progress. USGS has shown that in 2022, when compared to baseline loads from the 80s and the 90s, nitrogen loading has decreased by 23%. Total phosphorus loads have increased. To meet our long-term goal, we have more work to do, and that work requires funding. That's why President Biden's bipartisan infrastructure law has provided dedicated, sustained funding to increase collaboration and coordination among hypoxia task force states as we work toward reducing nutrient loads. Through this program, we've invested $60 million provided by the law to help the 12 Mississippi River Basin states, eligible tribes in those states, and task force partners implement and scale up their nutrient reduction strategies and advance progress toward the task force action plan goals. I had the pleasure of attending the task force public meeting in Arkansas and witnessed firsthand on the ground work in the state of Arkansas that has been implemented through this program. We heard updates from many other states and task force partners about their ongoing work that will soon be underway. Arkansas, for example, is implementing conservation practices in high priority areas, such as constructing 2-stage ditches designed to reduce agricultural nutrient runoff and mitigate flooding. Iowa, and my friend Mike Maig, is supporting trusted agricultural advisors that help farmers implement the Iowa nutrient reduction strategy. And Minnesota is scaling up adoption of conservation practices. State work plans are advancing our water quality goals while increasing climate resiliency and ensuring actions provide benefits to disadvantaged communities. States will submit work plans for even more innovative projects later this year or in 2025. The bipartisan infrastructure law also includes an $11.7 billion investment in clean water infrastructure that will support all states, including hypoxia task force states, in meeting these water quality goals. And through this funding from the American Recovery Plan and USDA's enormous investment in climate smart agriculture, $19.5 billion under the Inflation Reduction Act, we can make progress and like never before. These are exciting times. We have a long way to go, but I'm proud of the effort the federal team is putting in that's working with states and tribes and others to reduce Gulf hypoxia and improve water quality throughout the Mississippi River Basin. We've seen successes in making progress toward our shared water quality goals. We understand there's a lot more work to do and we're ready to get started. I look forward to continuing this crucial work. Thank you all.
Thank you, Bruno. We appreciate those comments. Next up is Mike Maig, Secretary Maig of the state of Iowa. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, and thanks to everyone who's joined us today. And let me add my thanks to the crews and research teams. I do serve as the Secretary of Agriculture for the state of Iowa, but this morning participating in this press conference in my capacity as the co-chair, along with Administrator Piggott of the Gulf of Mexico Hypoxia Task Force. And Bruno, always great to be with you. In person or otherwise. so always happy to be working together. The construction of the task force itself is the joining of the federal family of agencies with the 12 states across the region, and it allows for coordination and collaboration, as well as it's a venue to help address the progress, you know, that's being made, the barriers to that progress, and the resources that are needed and the research needs as well. Water quality is an extraordinarily important issue that requires all stakeholders to work together in an effort to improve water quality and mitigate the hypoxic zone in the Gulf. You know, I always say context is really important here. We must keep in mind the significance of the Mississippi River itself. This is a working river, the second largest river in North America, connecting all or parts of 31 states. It's a drainage basin that spans 1.2 million square miles. And a recent report highlighted that barge transport on the Mississippi River accounts for 92% of U.S. ag exports, so a significant contributor. An estimated 589 million tons of freight are moved on the river each year, with an estimated value of more than $405 billion annually. It's important to the livelihoods of many people, and our ability to use the Mississippi as an inland waterway to move goods supports the economies of many communities across our states, including mine in Iowa. Clearly, we have an interest in protecting this working river, and we have to balance all of this commerce with water quality. We need to have the ability to live, work, and play all across the region. So for the task force, this annual measurement of the size of the hypoxic zone is certainly an important consideration, but we do need to recognize the many variables that contribute to this size from year to year, and it does fluctuate as been noted, and that's why it's important to look across the averages. This year's measurement, of course, is coming out of a significant drought across the basin. Of course, we remember that the last 2 years were trending below average. Water flow and precipitation throughout the basin are certainly a key factor, and we just need to remember this each year. So weather is always going to be an important element to that variability, and our ability to understand that even more is critically important. The work that's happening throughout the basin is making a difference. We're seeing public and private partners in states across the region accelerating water quality work, and those implementation steps will only continue to positively impact our water. Each state is taking on the challenge of reducing nutrient loss and implementing their own nutrient reduction strategies in their own unique ways. States are, as you heard Bruno mention, states are developing or enhancing and leveraging dedicated funding sources that can help build momentum. And of course, we recognize that states are different. They've got unique geographic features. Our plans to address those specific needs are different. And our efforts collectively, though, are attracting more public and private partners, in addition to, of course, the federal funding that was referenced from EPA and USDA. I do want, every time I get a chance to represent the states, I want to just highlight a couple of things that we always poll the states and say, tell us something that's going on that you want me to highlight. Of course, in Iowa, we're proud of the fact that we've broken conservation adoption records the last 2 years. I expect that we will be announcing very soon in the next couple of weeks that we've yet again broken another record for the third year in a row. In Minnesota, in 2024, nutrient improvements led to the removal of 15 lakes from Minnesota's impaired waters list. In Illinois, the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency's NPDES permit point source in Illinois has achieved a 37% reduction in total phosphorus discharges since 2011. That exceeds their goal of 25% by 2025. In Tennessee, a focus on cover crops, $600,000 spent on cover crops in watersheds that are known to have high soil erosion rates. In Ohio, 535 producers in 65 Ohio counties enrolled 503,000 acres this spring in the H2 Ohio program. Missouri has set another record for conservation spending on soil and water conservation and nutrient loss reduction. This in $49.5 million in 2024, and that's an increase of $9.5 million from the previous fiscal year. Kentucky, pairing $1.6 million in ag and infrastructure funding to improve wastewater treatment and reduce soil erosion. Just one example of a project in one county. And Indiana just recently announced 1.7 million acres of farmland are now covered with a cover crop, one of the leaders in the nation, to be sure. And these are just a sampling of some of the success stories that need to be shared from across the states. So as we work to scale up and accelerate the adoption of practices, the momentum will continue to yield even more progress. The bottom line is, we all know there is more work to do. We need significant funding, technical construction resources. We need more municipalities, businesses, and farmers and landowners to say yes to conservation. We certainly need to continue the strong partnership that's established through the federal family of agencies to provide both resources and support, but we also need to address those barriers that exist, things like permitting, engineering. We need consistency and timeliness to keep moving forward. So as I conclude, on behalf of the states, I just want to again thank all the partners who are working across the region on this very, very important journey to make impactful progress on the Mississippi River Basin. And a thanks again to the team for the work on the actual measurement, but also the research that's ongoing. Let's continue to work together to leverage our resources to accelerate and scale up. Thank you.
Thank you, Secretary Nag, and thank you for that state perspective, multi-state perspective and drainage approach. All right, so our final panelist before we open up for Q&A from the press is Lori Sprague with USGS. Go ahead, Lori.
Thank you. Good morning. As Paul mentioned earlier, I am a hydrologist and national program manager with the US Geological Survey. But this morning, I'm here in my capacity as the US Department of the Interior representative on the Hypoxia Task Force Coordinating Committee. The role of the Department of the Interior on the task force is to provide scientific support to help understand more about the sources and movement of nutrients in the Mississippi River Basin. As part of that support, the U.S. Geological Survey has monitored nutrients in the Mississippi River since the 1970s. This long-term observational record is updated with new monitoring data each year, and the data is used both to forecast and understand the size of the zone each year, as well as to track progress toward the nutrient reduction goals that have been set by the Hypoxia Task Force. This year, stream flow in the Mississippi and Atchafalaya Rivers during May was about 5% above the long-term average. Nitrogen loads in May were about 7% below the long-term average, while phosphorus loads were 22% above the long-term average. These levels were likely one factor contributing to the above average size of the hypoxic zone this year. Over the longer term, recent science indicates that both nitrogen and phosphorus loads from the Mississippi River Basin into the Gulf will need to be reduced by 48% to meet the 2035 goal of reducing the five-year average size of the dead zone to less than 5,000 square kilometers. In support of this 2035 goal, the task force has also set an earlier interim goal of reducing nitrogen and phosphorus loads by 20% by the year 2025. The task force tracks reductions in nutrient loading from the Mississippi River Basin by comparing nitrogen and phosphorus loads delivered to the Gulf each year to a baseline period defined between 1980 and 1996. When that comparison is made, we want to be able to understand the role of changing stream flow each year. That's because higher precipitation and stream flows in the Mississippi River Basin will carry more nutrients to the Gulf, irrespective of any other actions that we're taking in the basin to manage nutrients. Likewise, lower precipitation and stream flows will carry fewer nutrients. So to track nutrient loading changes that are more likely the result of other factors, such as nutrient management and other human activities, the U.S. Geological Survey controls for this short-term variability in precipitation and stream flow during our analysis of long-term change, resulting in what we call a flow normalized load. The USGS has found that flow normalized nitrogen loads from the Mississippi River Basin into the Gulf of Mexico decreased below the 20% interim reduction target in the years 2020, 2021, and 2022. Overall, the change in flow normalized nitrogen loads between that 1980 to 1996 baseline and 2022, which is the most recent year with available trend results, was estimated to be a decrease of 25%. In contrast, the change in flow normalized phosphorus loads between that baseline period in 2022 was estimated to be a slight increase of 3%. In the case of both nitrogen and phosphorus, as you've heard from my fellow panelists, more work is going to be needed to reach that ultimate 48% reduction in loading needed to meet the 2035 goal for the size of the hypoxic zone. Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. And thank you all our panelists for their statements. We're going to jump in. We're doing perfect on time. And now we're going to hand it over to the press to ask questions. Very quickly, I'd like to point out that it's not every day that you get federal agencies, state agency representing multi states as a task force co-chair, and academia in the same panel on the same meeting. So I just want to highlight that, and it's very similar to the membership on the hypoxia task force. So it's really great to see the different levels and different agencies and institutions working toward the same goal. So we're going to open it up. Like I said, when we first started, please identify that you have a question in the chat, or feel free to write the question actually in the chat and I can read it for you. And we will unmute you to either ask your question or I will ask your question. Please identify which panelist, or if you feel free to ask the entire panel. But what we don't want to have happen is folks to not be able to ask questions because of IT issues or anything like that. So feel free to email me with any other questions that may come to you after this press conference, as this is a very large and technical issue, and sometimes questions pop up afterwards. And pretty much any requests that you have post press conference can be submitted to me in my email, which is in the chat currently. And I will make sure to respond because I know y'all are trying to write your articles and have deadlines. So I will do my very best to have very quick turnarounds on that. So I do see a question in the chat. I'm going to go ahead and kick off that way, but feel free to keep entering questions in the chat or identify that you do have a question in the chat, and I will make sure to that we unmute you and you can ask the question yourself. So next, the first question is from Mark Schleffstein, I think, hopefully I'm saying your name right. When will results of the East of River be announced? There's a subsequent question that I'll read afterwards. So I guess that question will be identified, and go ahead, Nancy, I think would be the best panelist to approach that question. So from Mark Schleffstein, when will the results of East of the River be announced? Nancy, go ahead. Nancy, you may need to unmute. Hey, Nancy.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we got you.
Oh, okay. The Pelican got back early this morning, and I haven't had a chance to map the area east of the river, but hopefully I'll have it done by this afternoon, and that number will be coming out as well.
Great, thank you.
Just to mention Brian Zwankowski of University of South Alabama has been out in that area and has documented low oxygen over quite a large area east of the river.
Okay, thank you for that. And the Mark has another question. It's directed for EPA, which would be Bruno Piggott. What is your agency's efforts to lower nitrogen, comma phosphorus, so both nutrient levels, by 2035? Bruno.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the question, Mark. Appreciate it. As you know, and as Mike knows, and everyone here, the effort to reduce nutrient loadings by 2035 is going to be a partnership effort. And we are working and have been investing $60 million provided by the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law to help the 12 Mississippi Basin states, tribes, and task force partners to implement and scale up their nutrient reduction strategies. As you may know, each state has put together nutrient reduction strategies, and the money that is allocated here, the $60 million I'm talking about provided by the law, is to help those states implement their policies, their efforts or strategies to reduce loadings from nitrogen and phosphorus. And as Mike outlined, different states have different specific geographic conditions, and each of those conditions is outlined, and strategies are put together in reaction to those different circumstances on the ground. And we are here to help both technically as well as funding wise to ensure that states are able to put in place those strategies that will help us reduce our nutrient loadings.
Thank you. And so next we had a question submitted in the Q&A. So by Allie Shanes, which is the question of why is eliminating and understanding the dead zone important on a broader scale? And is there an economic impact at play, and can it be a health risk to humans? So let's see, I'll open that one up. That seems like a broad question, broader scale. Nancy, do you want to answer that one? And anybody, yeah, any of the panelists, feel free to jump in as well.
Oh, can you hear me?
We got you.
Okay. It's a symptom of an ecosystem that is not functioning well, which is not good for the living resources. In fact, any fish that can swim out of the area does swim out, and that includes blue crabs and shrimp as well. So it reduces the accessible area for collection of these types of organisms for fisheries, both recreational and commercial. And it's just a symptom of changing water quality in watersheds that is happening around the globe. There's over 500 of these such areas around the globe, and the number just seems to be increasing, or the condition the conditions worsening.
Great, thank you. Go ahead.
You hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in on that briefly as well. I mean, some of the recent studies have indicated that, for example, brown shrimp fishery, which coincides with the setup of the hypoxia, we're finding that the shrimp are kind of aggregating around the edges of the hypoxic zone. So as that expands and contracts, it puts pressure on the folks that are going out to target those animals for the fishery. It also can kind of aggregate the animals into in ways spatially that might make them more susceptible to catch. And so we have to be careful not to move into over harvest. So there are fuel costs, planning costs, natural resource management costs associated with that. And it's not just brown shrimp. I mean, there are a host of different species. You know, for example, some recent estimates and historical papers have shown that croaker and menhaden might be affected. And while there are important fisheries in their own right, they're also forage fish for a whole variety of other commercially and recreationally important species in the Gulf. And, you know, if you look back, some of Nancy's work actually looking at the long-term geologic record, indicates that the area of the bottom that's been affected in the Gulf of Mexico over the last 100 or 50 years is substantial. And so all of the forage, the worms, the crabs, the bivalves that would ordinarily be living on the bottom may not have access to that habitat. And so that can generate long-term ecosystem impacts to the productivity of the Gulf of Mexico, which translates directly to social and economic impacts for the region.
Great, thank you. All right, so
this is Nancy again. I'd also like to say that sometimes these increases in nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, and different forms of nitrogen can lead to harmful algal blooms, which do have health effects on human beings.
That's correct, and has been documented on other areas of the Gulf. Okay, so thank you for that. I want to move on so we make sure, and thank you for addressing the health part of that second question, Nancy. So we're going to move on so we get as many questions as we can in the allotted time. The next is from Eva Tesfaye. Hope I got that one right. For Mike Naig, you mentioned there are barriers to getting conservation practices adopted. What are they, and how are you addressing them?
You bet. Thanks for the question. You know, as we look across the region, I will typically hear about funding being perhaps the most the biggest barrier. In that there needs to be a leveraging of resources, right? Bruno talked about the federal resources on the part of EPA and USDA. The long history of working with NRCS on conservation adoption across the country. States across the basin we're seeing an increase in state level funding that is being dedicated to these efforts, and then an increase in the private sector leveraging or partners bringing private resources to bear as well. And so that remains to be one of the biggest challenges, is around how do you put together the necessary funding to be able to accomplish these, to implement these strategies across the basin. One component of that, of course, is workforce. Name me an industry that isn't dealing with workforce challenges, and that's certainly true in the conservation space as well. So that kind of goes into the resource bucket. I am hearing some folks, and certainly in Iowa, we're experiencing some challenges around permitting of nitrate reducing wetlands in particular. So continuing to work with the Army Corps of Engineers on things like that, and again, talking about permitting and mitigation requirements, mitigation costs that might be associated with building those types of structures. And that's not just unique to us, there are others addressing those types of things across the basin as well. And I would just add to the ag economy is cyclical. We know that we're experiencing softness in the ag economy, which can create some challenges for folks to be implementing practices. And of course, the cost of everything, the cost of building infrastructure on the wastewater on the point source side as well. So Those are some of the headwinds that we see, but I would say chief among the barriers would be resource needs.
Thank you, Secretary Meg. All right, so moving on, I see a question here from Maggie Cates. What are the potential impacts of a larger dead zone to marine resources east of the Mississippi River off the coasts of Mississippi and Alabama? Nancy, would you like to approach this?
Sure, I'll take a stab at it. The similar sorts of resources live east of the Mississippi as do west of the Mississippi, fish that live on the bottom and shrimp. There are also artificial reefs that are present that are trying to increase the production of fish. And those are also affected by low oxygen so that they're not as viable a solution to decreased fisheries production. So there are the same sorts of problems and similar issues with water quality. The low oxygen east of the river is a combination of river inputs from Mississippi, but also the Mississippi River Delta is very leaky, and much of the low oxygen that we see east of the river is due to nutrients from the Mississippi River itself.
Thank you for that. Yeah, and I'll speak for as a scientist, as a co-director of the Northern Gulf Institute, that understanding when you make a comparison of east and west of the river, west of the river, we have decades of data. East of the river is just starting, and there's many different drivers and water flow mechanisms and drivers. So really, the understanding east of the river is very large, and the need is great to really understand both the drivers and understand the monitoring conditions on an annual basis. All right, so moving on, let's see here. We see a question from Mark Lefstein again. So what happens if the goal is not met in 2035? I guess that would be directed toward a task force member or chair. Does anybody want to grab that, Bruno or Mike?
Sure, I'm happy to start and Mike can join me. But first of all, I would just say we redouble our efforts to reduce the loadings in the basin. Whether the goals met in the interim goals met in 2035 or the final goal, we will keep working toward that goal. I will say also that's the whole reason Secretary Naig and myself convene the Gulf Hypoxia Task Force every year. We understand that there are creative solutions to addressing nutrient loadings being employed in different states. And getting everyone together to talk about those creative efforts is one way to spread the news about them to help ensure that we make faster progress and reach our goal. So one reaction is we keep working. We keep working to reduce those nutrient loadings. The second is we are continually working to explore new and creative ideas for reducing nutrients. And I will say Secretary Naig and Iowa are leaders in that field.
Bruno, I would just add to that. Well said. The work must continue, and that again, what I hear from states across the basin is that folks are focused on scaling up and acceleration. In many cases, and it's true in the case of Iowa, where we've spent the last 10 years establishing the sound foundation that we will continue to work off of in order to achieve our goals. But right now, it's all about trying to scale up, do things faster, reach more folks, leverage more resources. And I think that's universal across the basin.
Great, thank you for that. Okay, so
I was unable to unmute on that Mississippi-Alabama question. This is Sean Corson. I just wanted to point out that east of the river, it is important for us to keep an eye on heavier precipitation loads and the impact that may have at the spillways. And historically, we've seen that those freshwater inputs have led to harmful algal blooms, and freshwater can significantly impact the oyster industry. And so just with respect to the economic impacts and potential challenges faced by those areas, I wanted to point that out.
Terrific, yes, that's correct. So I'm about to open it up to everybody else who's called in or may have a question that's popped up from our answers from the panelists. And I do see a logistical question here from Ali Shanes saying, will there be able to get a recording sent to us at the end of the meeting? The data file is so large in past years, because it's an hour long audio file, they don't attach to emails and very difficult. So we make sure to get it to Noah as fast as we can once it's packaged up and it's posted either on the NGI website and or the NOAA website. So we'll make that available as soon as possible. But it is a large file and it's difficult to send out and attach. So that'll be the process, and please submit questions via the email I provided. If you can't find it in a timely manner, and I'll make sure that we provide the locations once the links are public. So let's see, I'm gonna go ahead and open it up. I see a couple of folks here that have called in. Any last questions from the group? And or call-ins. Let's see, I see they may be panelists that are the call-ins. So we may actually not have any direct call-ins. Is that correct, Clay?
Let's see. Right.
I see a Courtney Biggs that may have called in. Go ahead and unmute the folks that have called in and we can identify, Clay. And if you have any last questions, please enter it in the chat, the Q&A, or just virtually raise your hand and I will make sure you're identified before we conclude.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, this is Doug Daigle with the Louisiana Hypoxia Working Group. I just wanted to see if the panelists could clarify something for the public, which is that even though that 2035 target date is, you know, a little over 10 years out, we are in the window now to be doing what we need to do to reach that. And if they have something that can help, you know, elucidate that, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and do last call. We're unmuting callers and identifying raised hands and or questions in the chat. Please do so now. And if you do come up with questions after this press conference, feel free to email them directly to me. My email is in the chat. It is pmickle@ngi.msstate.edu. Last call for questions. Okay. Well, thank you all very much. We really enjoyed the press conference, and we really thank all of our press visitors and panelists. This is a really good group. It's been successful, and it's obviously having successes, and it's really great to see the different levels here in one forum where we can discuss what's going on in the present and future. So thank you all. Have a wonderful day. And again, please submit any subsequent questions after this event via email, which is in the chat. I will leave it up post conference for a few more minutes to allow you to identify any questions through the forum and or enter it in and or make requests via email. Thank you and have a wonderful day.
Nancy, thanks all the participants and of course Noah for funding this over the many years.
Thank you all.
Thank
you. Have a great day.
Mm-hmm.